If you know Mad Magazine, then you know the work of my guest, Dave Berg. He joined Mad Magazine in 1956 as an artist and writer, and then created the Lighter Side series in 1964. The Lighter Side is often about what is really going through someone's mind, the nasty or sick thoughts your inner self is having as you smile and wish someone a nice day. I shouldn't neglect the more profound work of Dave Berg, such as his books My Friend God and Roger Kaputnik and God, for which, by the way, he received an honorary degree in theology. In 1975, Dave Berg was nominated for an Academy Award by the American Academy of Humor. His Lighter Side books have been translated into 12 languages, which means his sense of the bizarre has international appeal. Dave Berg's biography says that his works are on permanent exhibit at the UN Museum for Humor and Satire, located in Bulgaria. I'm still trying to figure out if that's a joke or a tourist attraction.
No, for real.
It's really in Bulgaria?
Yeah, it's United Nations, and they have to give each country something else. Oh. You know, they have to throw them a bone.
Well, Dave Berg, welcome to Fresh Air.
I want to say something.
Okay.
To all you people persons of Philly, Jersey, Delaware, our hostess, since this is not Radio Vision, her name is Terry Gross, and gross means big, and she's anything but.
Well, let's talk about you for a while.
My favorite subject.
You joined Mad Magazine back in about 1956. What were your first impressions of Mad when you walked into the door the first time to assume your position there?
I'll tell you something. There's a story for you. Actually, it started before that, but the first day I actually went to work, I came in, the publisher walks into the office, and all the guys says, "Hey, Bill Gaines, the hell with you. Hey, Bill, I'm clearing this up." It's cleaning it up. Actually, I don't know what they were saying. "Go to hell, Wood Gaines," and all that sort of kind of thing. Everybody insulting him. And he smiles, and he walks into his office, and I say, "How could you do that? That's the boss!" And then came the classic line, "If we don't say it, he thinks we don't love him." That's the atmosphere of Mad Magazine.
What are some of the physical setups there like? I mean, I can just imagine, like, what gets put on the walls, and, what kind of weird atmospheres are created to help nourish your creativity?
There are no weird atmosphere, and I got to straighten it out.
First of all,
we don't work there. We don't, the freelancers. It's only an immediate staff, and they work. They work hard. And basically, the very few laughs in the laugh factory that is Mad Magazine, it's very, very hard work. We call for an appointment. They see us one at a time. We couldn't possibly work together. First of all, it takes complete concentration. And second of all, these are guys who fool around when you get them together. In fact, one of the biggest things our editor is always yelling, "Go home, go home." The moment two of us are together, that becomes a little party.
So you've done most of your work at home?
Everybody does. Have their own studio. It usually ends up being your own home. And it's a write-off. But when you go in, when I go in for a story conference, it's the hardest I work. First of all, it's only about twice a month. Because those editors are pretty bright boys, and I have to mentally fence with them. And I come home exhausted. It's worse than digging a ditch.
When you've been through a lot of periods with Mad Magazine. You started in the 50s.
Everybody was toned down. We were supposedly anti-establishment. We were supposed to have started the whole thing. And then came the 60s, where they took our little joke seriously. And their idea of anti-establishment was violence. We were tickling with a feather. They were throwing bombs and rioting. I did not approve because I felt they were half-grown, half-educated, and half-doped up, and how could they form an opinion? And so while we didn't become their enemy, it was a matter of, like, hey, slow down. Don't jump so quick.
Curious thing, because a lot of the people who were doing the revolution, so to speak, in the 1960s were people who really grew up on Mad Magazine.
There's a certain connection that they misinterpreted us, and we didn't like it. As a result, we began to move sort of the other way.
Get more conservative?
We stood in the middle. No, we just stood in the middle and said, you cut it out and you cut it out. You know, the kids and the establishment. If you remember, the establishment was getting involved in the Vietnam War, which we were against, so the kids were just going too wild. And it personally hit me when the powers that be said, they like you, they'll listen to you, go talk to them. And so I was sent out to the campuses. And what you had mentioned there is really a sort of writing sermons, funny sermons, which when my publishers, that is the book publishers, heard about it, said we want it in book form. And that's where my friend God came, and the other one, Roger Kaputnik and God. And right here in Philadelphia, I got that honorary doctorate. There's this college here called the Reconstruction Rabbinical College or something like that. And it sort of required reading in a number of places, not just that.
What did you say in it, in My Friend God?
The essence? You want the whole book?
No.
Oh, main thing. I think what I... Well, let's see. I came from the point of view... I think my opening sentence was something like, while you read this book, I make you Jewish. and then at the end of the last sentence and the thing, that it was something like, okay, now go be what you were, but do it. Well, I've forgotten this. It's a long time ago. Now,
what was it supposed to have to do with radical unrest on the campuses?
Oh, give them something else. Replace the false god they were worshiping, which was no god, with a real god. Okay? In other words, it came by accident. I didn't really... I'm not a deeply religious man. I think I know my theology pretty well, I know my Bible, but it came by accident when one day I said, the first time, very first time out, I said, and go with God, he's a friend of mine. And I said, ooh, is that clever? And I said, hey, I got something. There it is. That's where to hang the hat. And so I pushed out a little. But it was all done in humor. Did I ever have trouble? Yeah, twice. Twice I had trouble. Even before I went out, I had inside information that they're going to get you. Why would they want to get me? I'm such a sweet guy. Well, I think the first one was up in Canada. McGill University, that's what it was. And a whole gang of them came, they took the first row, and they started to heckle me. Well, one at a time I can handle them. But when they all began to shout, then I said, okay, all of you, step outside, we're going to settle it physically. I now place them in a position that no matter what they did, they're losers. Because if they take me on, they're cowards, and if they don't take me on, they're cowards. And so I went outside, and I waited for them, and they wouldn't come out. Now, big, strong me? No, I didn't realize that the rest of the audience went outside, stood across the street, waiting for them to come out. They were going to get them, too. That was the first time it happened. Then it happened once more, and this time I said, no, we're going to settle right here on the spot, and the security of the school stepped in. After that, the word got to me was, lay off Berg, he's crazier than we are. And it stopped. And it sounds as if I had a hard time. Actually, I was just
It sounds like you handled it really well.
I was mostly getting standing ovations. And, look, I like it. That's a nice thing to get.
Well, you've really been... you know, an important figure to different generations, which is, you know, a kind of unusual thing.
Right. Before we get away from it, why did that business of acting tough work? No, not I'm not a brute. I'm a father. I'm a father image. And I said, cut it out. And no fathers were saying, cut it out. You see, that's why it worked.
I think it also worked because you put them in an absurd situation. I mean, like you said, they're really in a losing... It would be absurd for them to fight you.
Certainly at the age... I was now in middle age, just about getting into middle age, and at a younger age, I don't think they would have stood a chance. I was a tough boy. And besides, a soldier and the whole thing, and I knew something about fighting, even though that was outnumbered. It's about a dozen.
What are your feelings about generation in their teens now? I mean, what is your sense of, like, what is making this generation and what kind of humor or what kind of style appeals to them? You know, for your audience, let me put it that way, who...
I wish we knew what our audience was. We don't know. We get mail from little kids, bright 10-year-olds, and we get mail from professionals.
What does, have you done any parodies, for instance, on punk rock, for instance?
They did. Wait, I don't write parody. Parody would be you take a song and you slightly alter the words.
I remember an example in Mad from probably the late 50s. It was My Blue Heaven changed to My Bomb Shelter.
All right. As a matter of fact, one question that's usually asked, don't you get sued? The only real suit that ever meant anything. No, we don't get sued very much. Was Irving Berlin. We had done parodies on his thing, and he sued, and it was decided that a parody is not plagiarism.
Oh, how interesting.
I don't see the connection. They merely took, sung to the tune of Irving Berlin so-and-so, and different words completely. And we won. We've had silly suits like we make up dumb names. It turns out once somebody had a name like that. I won't mention the name. I don't remember it. And she sued.
Did you win?
Oh, because laughed out of court.
Oh, good. okay, you're saying that your work is not parodied. But your work is very involved, I think, with styles that are around at the moment because you take people that you can recognize.
Oh, yes. Whatever's going on at the time. I lose track because I work so far ahead. You must understand, it's nonstop. Remember, I'm also working on books, and it's such a fierce pace. And there's no time to look backwards. You were looking at some of my old stuff there, and I was amazed to see it myself. I had forgotten I did it.
What are some of the more crazy fads that you found yourself referring to in your work through the years?
The crazy fads are the normal fads. Oh, the wild hair. Ha! I say that looking at Terry, and her hair's a mess.
Well, like when if you're writing for hair, you know, about hair, for instance, in the late 60s or something, how much do you want to get inside something before commenting on it or before using it? You know,
all right.
How much do you want to, like, mingle with people, whether it's that they're smoking dope or playing with hula hoops or listening to a kind of music or wearing floral dusters or whatever? How much do you want to really know about why they're doing what they're doing?
Let's back up here now. Wait. Gotta back up. Okay. Roll the tape back. It's now 1945. We took Iwo Jima. I was in that mess. And then they start civilizing the place, and they wanted to make a newspaper. So they looked at everybody's background, and I had a background, so I became a war correspondent. And that was very important, because I learned how to ask questions. Okay, during the 60s, I was a war correspondent all over again. It was another war. So my things are researched. What is done in humor is attacked as if I'm going to write a serious article. My research is, first of all, interviews. Second of all, what about myself? You know, if this happened to me, it's happening to everybody else. I do look at myself. And the third is I read articles on, straight articles on the subject. And now you got all your information. Line it up. This is what I'm going to say. Now go make it funny. How do you make it funny? How do you make it? Come here, I'll give you a subject. Go make it funny. You know, that's why I laugh sometimes. Somebody suggests an area. And then I bust my head and I come up with a punchline. He says, I really wrote that. It's ridiculous. What could you do with it? I'll give you with a million subjects. What are you going to do with it? That's where the pro comes in. And the way I get to write the humor is, I take a hammer and I bang myself on the head until it hurts so bad that I can't stand it anymore. Then for relief, I sit down and write humor. That's how difficult it is.
Well, that's very unlike the release of laughing when you come across your work, which is funny.
That the end result is that punchline.
That's kind of why humor is funny, isn't it? Because it's sometimes, anyways, because it's about painful things, too.
First of all, you have to identify. And then there has to be a release. Oh, I can remember a very serious situation. Let's go back to World War II. We were in the bowels of the ship, a submarine was tracking us. We were expecting any minute for that torpedo to hit. Everybody's nerves were on edge. And somebody yelled out, "Anybody want to buy a watch cheap?" And everybody busted up. It's not such a funny line, but it was a moment of release.
And I guess it's a release for you, because when you found something, because you found that funny thing. In the 1950s, let's go back to there.
Yeah,
for a
that
minute.
Was like where, the nice period.
What were you writing about? Because there was a big generation gap then, but it was a different sort of one from the 60s.
Gentle things. As a matter of fact, we have a book here. It's called Daybreak's Mad Trash. It's a wise author who knows the title of his own book. And it's like a collection of the worst things I've ever done. And it has to do with the 50s. And it dealt with gentle things. What have I got? A mad look at Christmas. And it just took a here's something. I took the seasons. Gentle things. There was winter, summer, and so on, fall, spring. That's what I'm... things weren't serious yet. Now, none of these get into the 60s yet, where things got serious. Here was something we were discussing before we went on the air. It's called skin diving. That's when skin diving first became popular. And to show how vulnerable we are, or what kind of people are out there, what it does is trace the history of skin diving. And it's the first sentences. Scientists tell us that life on Earth can be traced back millions of years to its origin in the sea around us. I have made no personal statement. I have stated a fact of what other people are saying. We got mail saying I should be hung from the neck until I'm thoroughly miserable. Shot in the electric chair. I mean,
From anti-Darwinists?
People who were against evolution, the preaching of evolution. Now, I haven't preached evolution. I didn't say anything about evolution.
You said scientists tell us that.
Yeah, so this is what scientists tell us. So, you know, immediately I went to my clergyman and I said, well, what about this? How do you feel about this? He says, the Bible tells us the world was created in 6 days. How long is one of God's days? Is that 1 million years? 2 million years? So it's possible. We don't know. So we leave it open.
Why do you think that someone would bother to sit down and write such an emotional, serious, angry, searing letter about something that's first of all obviously meant to be funny, second of all not, as you said, giving your point of view, but saying scientists tell us that? I mean, what are these people doing reading Mad Magazine in the first place? That's what I'd like to know.
Just think about how unhappy they are to have that kind of hate in them. First of all, they're not religious. Whatever they think they are not religious. It's an excuse to kill, like the Red Brigade in Italy, the Bader Mannheim group in Germany, the Red Army in Japan, the PLO. They don't really have political ideas. They want to kill. They're bloodthirsty. Right?
You strike me as having strong political views now. Do you use them?
Do I have some?
Because you were talking about how in the 50s things were lied about the seasons, skin diving, house.
I'm not fanatical on anything. Oh, about the strongest I've ever felt is, I suppose, Israel. And even then, I'm not fanatic, and I will make donations. I think it's a worthy cause.
Would you, or would anyone else on the staff of MAD, use Israel as the basis of some kind of storyline? The question is actually, how are some materials sacred to you so that you wouldn't, you know, use them in something that's going to be funny or, you know, satirical, biting?
Well, that reminds me of, again, the extremists that you have to deal with. I once wrote a piece, a very mild piece, about a kid with a lemonade stand. And business isn't going good, so he finds excuses to blame it on everybody else why he isn't selling his lemonade. And he ends up saying, well, it's the oil prices and the Arabs raise the oil. He looks for all devious kind of reasons for it. And the whole idea that, you know, he's a loser, that's the point of it. I got mail from the PLO threatening me.
Really?
They couldn't even take a joke on that. Now, they've lost their sense of humor. You look at every one of those groups. During the 60s, in the book that I wrote, My Friend God, where I spent analyzing the kids, I said, those laughless children, laughless, they didn't laugh. They lost their sense of humor. And when they lose their sense of humor, they lose their humanity.
You know, I think that when someone is involved in human... I remember the women's movement got the same criticisms back in the 60s. And it always feels different when something that you're involved in is being parodied and not taken seriously, particularly if it's something that you've just involved yourself in and feel very sincere and committed about. I remember the first time in a National Lampoon when I saw... I think it was the Whole Earth Catalog being lampooned. And I was just surprised, you know.
There's no such magazine.
What?
You're making up a name.
The Lampoon.
You made up a name.
What do you mean?
Don't listen to her, ladies and gentlemen. She'll know what she's saying.
Oh, yeah.
No, they are not competition. I just think that is what I mean.
Yeah.
They supposedly learned at our knee. We are supposedly set the pace.
Uh-huh.
And they learned poorly.
Why do you say that?
Bad taste. No self-censorship. And as their professor, I mark them zero. They're full of hate, besides they're bigoted, and there's no humor in it. All they have is a lot of expensive paper. And terribly, terribly bigoted.
So you think that one should really draw the line about what you're going to play with in humor?
Exactly. And what's more, they're influencing these minds that are so pliable. I remember listening to some of their editors get on a radio program, and they began to make jokes about the lampshades that were made of Jewish skin. And they just went on and on with it, this unbelievable bad taste, and then it was a call-in program. Now the young kids started to call in, and now they were making these unbelievable bad taste humor. Until, like, now the parents started to call in, screaming with agony. And they shut their program down pretty quick. But this is they're setting a bad example. Why are we wasting time talking on these no-talent, bad-taste, guys?
No, really, they're bad guys. Is it the role of humor, though, to set a good example?
Like somebody, a minister once wrote a book about Mad Magazine. How could you write a book? But he did. Wherein he said it's better than Sunday Fair. And behind that pile of garbage at his Mad Magazine that beats the heart of a rabbi. Okay? Which is true, because there is a tremendous sense of ethics and morals. And now I'm going to shock everybody. Headquarters at Boy Scouts tell me that there is no other organization that has as many Scoutmasters in it as Mad Magazine. In other words, our people are solid. I think we have 5. I'm one of them, by the way. One Cubmaster from Mexico. Our editor is a member of the Boy Scout fraternity, that sort of thing.
I'll tell you something. When I was reading your biography and I read that you were a Scoutmaster, I was actually surprised. Because I think of a lot of your stuff as, mocking certain values, whether they're, you know, inner values or, you know, middle class values, household values. They're not necessarily sacred things, but they are values. I easily imagine in one of your things, like a Boy Scout with this very round, kind of chocolate covered face, being. Being in it and not being the boy who we look to as being the good kid, but being the kind of, schlep within the frame or something.
Well, let me give you an actual one that I did. First of all, I drew me in a Scout uniform. And I say, I am doing it for boyhood. I put Bill Gaines in, who's a publisher of Mad, answering me. The exact dialogue I don't remember. Well, essentially, it came down to, I am doing it for boyhood. I'm the boy. In other words, most people do these things for self-gratification, for awards and that sort of thing. It's a little bit of the truth. It's not the full truth. There is part of me that simply likes to do it.
Mm-hmm. No, because I was thinking that you'd probably find the uniform, you know, and the little tie that you wear if you wear, I think you wear a tie, and, sitting around the fire. I'm sure you're from spent a lot of urban time.
Uh-huh. No, I was born in the mm-hmm. city and then moved to the suburbs and became scoutmaster in the suburbs.
It's easy to see all that as being absurd.
In other words, what I do particularly, what others have written about me, is that it's Middle America. And what is Middle America? And you want to analyze what Middle America is?
Sure.
Let's both of us do it, because it's, I'm not quite sure. It's moral, right?
Family-oriented.
Very family-oriented, community-oriented.
And
Bible belt.
One of the things frequently going on in your strips is the turbulence within the family. The family is the bastion of security, but there's a lot of double-edged, double-faced communication going on.
Right. During the 60s, I would have to divide my article, every article, like in half, one half taking one side, one half the other, and it all depended who was reading it. They would say, you're a wild, screaming radical, and the other one would say, you're a conservative, fascist pig. And here I am being right down the middle. But everybody sees what they want to see.
What do your neighbors think of you? Or your work?
My neighbors, that part's a little painful to me. Because prior to becoming known, they call me Dave. And then I began to have sort of best-selling books. And I slowly became Mr. Berg. And I kept screaming, I'm still Dave! Yes, Mr. Berg. Now that kind of thing is a little painful.
So being a star, at least a formality in your neighborhood.
You've heard everybody. Anybody who makes it in any way, they start complaining. It's not an easy road. It's not comfortable. There was a group I used to play poker with every Sunday. And one time we were in the midst of a poker game when my friend's wife threw down the New York Times. And there was the New York Times debating with me on something I wrote in Mad. And I think it had to do with this article. Anyway, that doesn't matter. That's the one on skin diving. I believe that was it. It doesn't matter. That's what it was, but was not important. The fact that somebody picked it up, read it, and said, you're getting too big for us. And that was the last time we ever played poker. And it's still hurting. The knife is in there and it won't come out. Because I just wanted to still be one of the boys.
Mm-hmm.
And they put me up on the pedestal, and that's a lonely place to be.
It's always hard to understand that, since everybody wants to usually be recognized.
Oh, I don't do that ego thing. Nice to be recognized.
But you know, since you're so much into... what people are really saying in their heads, you know, the little thought balloons that appear frequently in your work, where the true nature of what someone's thinking is going on.
Oh, yeah.
Do you think people think that you are always in your head having this little mind balloon?
Of course. I don't deny it. I think you're looking at, you have a book there called Modern Thinking, where I base the whole book on what people really think and don't say.
Oh, there's one where someone's walking down the street and he's saying, oh, I don't know what it is, I must be sick, all I can think about is sex, and he's walking down a crowded street. There's little thought balloons in everyone else's head of, you know, chasing each other through the bedroom, romping in the hay, undressing someone.
The basic principle, I think I said it before, if it's happening to you, it's happening to everyone else.
So you work a lot internally because it's happening
to
you.
Right. I find that I'm an awfully ordinary schnook inside. It's like being of it, but not in it. In other words, if you're standing smack dab in the middle of a crowd, you can't count how many people there are or what they're doing. But if you stand a little aside, not above or better, but aside, you can start counting and looking. And that's where the position I'm at. But I'm really no better. I'm just as klutzy and just as schnooky.
Do things strike you as being funny a lot? Do you often get just kind of overtaken with this feeling of absurdity, the kind of absurdity that, you know, appears in your work? Yeah.
I know this, I cannot be angry.
Why?
I can't let my anger come out at all. Whatever it does, I'm in trouble. I get bad mail. I got into trouble a couple of months ago. I was furious at what the young kids were attacking the old ladies.
Yeah.
And I wrote a piece that wasn't funny. It was just simply angry. And I got very bad mail on that. You know, we want to see you funny. Never mind. Let the others make the statements, that kind of thing. So I learned, keep away from the heavy subjects. The article I'm working on right now, I originally called it anger. And the editor says it's more annoyances rather than anger. But if I get angry, they're not going to like it. In other words, they want me gentle. And that's why, here, we have a book I did that's called Mads Dayberg Takes a Loving Look. Only from the mail we got did we get the idea of calling it a loving look. They say, that's the way I see things. I don't chastise. It's like a father saying, that's not so nice, without getting angry.
Who are some of your favorite comedians? Or satirists, cartoonists?
Well, of course, Buchwald is a political cartoonist. I just discovered a writer. Peter DeVries, is that his name?
Yeah, Peter DeVries.
Yeah, he is fantastic. I didn't read the whole book. I just picked up and got to read a few pages. He is fantastic. Where every line is a funny line besides his plot being funny. I've never seen any writer do it that well. I can't wait to finish the book. And that's the trouble. You can't read for fun anymore. I have to read everything for business. Now that book has been put aside because that's for fun.
Uh-huh.
And it's been so many years since I read for fun. Everything is, what can I use?
What do you find that's really usable now, you know, 1978, that's kind of fun to use? You know, the things that strike you as being fairly peculiar to this year or this period or a certain generation within this time that is really going to, you know, work well or has worked well for you?
Well, we're kind of a middle of a pendulum swing. You remember, it went the 60s. It was all the way up there to one extreme. We're now in the middle of that swing, and it's going the other way. So I suppose it's a little slow. You know what I mean? It hasn't picked up momentum.
What hasn't picked up momentum?
Whatever the movements are, the general feeling, things have calmed down. It's so pitiful to hear of an occasional radical. He's still holding on to those great days in the 60s. Some stories are very, very sad. I know of a case where somebody in our area, where I come from, was a high politico. His son was a radical. And he was hounded out of office because that's the thing they held against him. And just like last week, they caught this kid after 10 years of being on the lam. Now, for what reason? I mean, what did he need it for? I mean, the revolution, the Vietnam War is finished. Now, forget it already. Come on, you grow up a little. You're a middle-aged man now. In 10 years, if you were 25, you're now 35. I don't know what his age is. Probably is about 35. You're still being a kid radical? There comes a time for that, to be ended, over. Moderation. Anyway, the father had to resign and leave the state. It was so pitiful. And I know the man.
What were your politics like when you were young?
I was a moderate. Always was a moderate.
Mm-hmm.
I can remember saying as a teenager, I don't see any difference between Nazism and communism. Same thing. I still believe it. And we always think of Hitler of having killed all those people. What did we say? 6 million Jews, and something like 11 million and something is the number we give it. But what about Stalin? Would he kill about 50 million?
Let me ask you something. We were talking before about, you know, if some things should be considered sacred and humor should not, they should not be used for humorist purposes.
Right,
and
right.
We're talking a bit about the Lampoon group. What do you think of Mel Brooks's movie in which he has the big Springtime for Hitler routine where it's staged, you know, it's a big musical comedy, lots of flashy tap dancing.
Well, I didn't see it,
mm-hmm.
but I know he meant well. But how can I judge if I didn't see it?
And if you haven't heard it, you can't, of course.
No. No, when Mel Brooks is funny, there's practically nobody funnier. But he could lay an egg, too.
Well, your work is very funny, and I enjoy your work, Dave Berg, and I want to thank you very much for being here on Fresh Air this afternoon.
Well, I love you, too.
I've been speaking with Dave Berg. He is a writer and artist for Mad Magazine. He has many books available. A recent one is called Mad Looks at Modern Thinking. There's Dave Berg's Trash, which is a collection of work from about the period of the 50s. And, of course, there's Mad Magazine, which is now, I believe, celebrating its 25th birthday.
25th birthday.
Well, happy birthday.
For its occasion, I dyed my hair silver.
Okay.
Whoa, before that, it used to be puce.
This is Fresh Air. You're listening to WUHY-FM in Philadelphia.